And the committee meeting of House Committee on Agricultural and Natural Resources here April 5th, 2007. And we're going to open a public hearing and, I guess just a public hearing, on House Bill 2992. So we'll hear a short explanation from our administrator and then we'll get some people.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2992 would allow the division of a lot or parcel in a forest zone or mixed farm and forest zone into two parcels if, first, one parcel is to be sold to a provider of public parks or open space or a not-for-profit land conservation organization, and, second, the remaining parcel is large enough to support a dwelling. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral.
So our first panel will be Ray Wilkerson from OFIC, Esther Lev, Wetlands Conservancy, Patty Case, Green Diamond Resources. Do you want to come forward?
Mr. Chair?
And?
Well, and I don't know if Representative Burley is here for this bill.
No.
Okay. So since I'm a chief sponsor of this, can I just say a few words?
Absolutely.
I'm happy to do it from here. And
okay. Leave them there.
They can all come up. I'm going to be very short. Mainly I'm going to introduce it, and then these guys are the experts. But I just wanted to, for the record, make sure the committee members knew what the intent of this was. And I want to thank you for this hearing today, and also thank you for the opportunity to have people come up and testify. This bill addresses a problem that our land conservation organizations have encountered when trying to protect and preserve some of our most ecologically valuable areas. I came aware of this, I think, 4 years ago. And so we're here to, I think we have a really good solution this time. And frequently these organizations want to acquire unique areas such as saltwater marshes along with forested buffer areas near those marshes. Yet under current law, a parcel in a forest zone or a mixed farm and forest zone cannot be divided in order to provide this buffer, and that was the issue here. House Bill 2992 will allow a division of forest land if the parcel is to be used for a park, green space, or open space, or is to be sold to a land conservation organization. The bill is a reasonable solution to an obstacle faced by those trying to protect Oregon's distinctive natural areas. You will hear from others today, like those in front of you, about the two-year struggle that the Wetlands Conservancy has undergone in trying to acquire high-quality estuarine wetlands in Yaquina Bay estuary area. And the Wetlands Conservancy has been working to purchase lands adjacent to a 300-foot forested buffer area. Under current law and current Oregon land use regulations, the purchase of these lands and the forested buffer will create illegal tax lots. So this bill will allow for the creation of legal tax lots and then the process of conservation in perpetuity of an important estuary resource. I want to thank the supporters of the bill. Many of them worked very hard on this. And I certainly want to call to your attention that we have, I think, the support of almost all of the coastal caucus on this bill, and especially because it affects your areas. So I want to thank the chair for also being a co-sponsor, and I saw that Representative Burley, who's also in the audience, is a co-sponsor as well. So with that, I'll hand it over to the experts in the field.
Thank you, Representative Dingfelder. Mr. Chairman, I'm Ray Wilkerson, Oregon Forest Industries Council, and I basically just want to introduce the other two members of this panel and tell you what our interest is. Esther Lev is with the Wetlands Conservancy, and Patty Case is with Green Diamond Resources Company. Green Diamond is a member of OFIC and has been for a long time, both in its current under its current name and its former name, which is, you may be more familiar with, the Simpson Timber Company. And this bill is designed, as Representative Dingfelder indicated, to address this specific situation, and it's the last piece needed to allow this transaction to be consummated that people have been working on for some time. The written material that you're going to receive on this includes both an aerial photo and a map, which allows you to visualize kind of what we're talking about here, and it's a very impressive area. I had the privilege of taking a tour by boat, which is the only way you can really see this, in the Yaquina Bay a couple years ago, and it's really, once you see it, you can really understand why this is a special place that's deserving of special attention, and that's why this bill is before you today, and we appreciate your consideration, and I'll turn it over to the other two panelists.
Thank you, Ray.
Mr. Chair, I'm Esther Lev, and I'm the Executive Director of the Wetlands Conservancy. And I would just, if you, a picture is worth a thousand words. And so this is what this bill will allow us to protect. And 4 years ago, the Wetlands Conservancy, in partnership with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, was granted $1 million from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Coastal Grants Fund. And that money was for acquisition of high-quality estuarine wetlands on the Oregon coast and the Aquinnah Estuary. And it rated fifth in the nation, and there was more than five applications that way. It's a very competitive thing. So that says a lot that people recognize the importance of Aquinnah Estuary. It supports seven different salmonid species and a lot of different bird species that are both state and federally listed as threatened. We did a prioritization. We worked with the Mid-Coast Watershed Councils to determine where were the most important areas and then worked with willing landowners who were interested in selling those properties. So we have been working with Green Diamond on acquisition of over 500 acres of land in the Aquinnah Estuary. And as has been said, is we've run into this problem because of the forest zone parcel law. And so what this will allow us to do is to proceed forward and for us to actually protect some of the important estuarine wetlands in Oregon. So thank you.
Chairman Robelin, members of the committee, I'm Patty Case. I work as a public and regulatory affairs manager for Green Diamond Resource Company. As Ray mentioned, you probably know us as Simpson, which we were for about 114 years. I'm still getting used to the new name myself. We own 120,000 acres in Tillamook and Lincoln counties here in Oregon. I'm testifying in support, of course, of House Bill 2992. Again, this bill will facilitate sale of just over 500 acres of marsh, tidelands, riparian areas on the Aquinnah River to the Wetlands Conservancy. We have been working with the Wetlands Conservancy for several years on this transaction. We feel that an organization such as the Wetlands Conservancy is a market-based solution to conservation. While some areas that we're looking at in the Aquinnah Bay area are suitable for active forest management, we've determined that they'd serve a higher and better use in the hands of a conservation organization. The area, as Esther mentioned, is prime habitat for salmon, steelhead, trout, eagles, murrelets, waterfowl, big game, et cetera, et cetera. We've identified five tracts to be included in this sale. The parcels are identified in the map that's included in the your information. Passage of House Bill 2992 simply provides the necessary land use tools to complete this transaction while maintaining flexibility for long-term forest management on the remaining parcels. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rob Bovet.
Okay. Are
we okay? Are they ready? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Rob Bovet, Assistant County Counsel for Lincoln County. Really, I don't have much to add other than what you've already heard. It's pretty much been said. What I have provided you is a letter strongly supporting this piece of legislation signed by all three members of our Board of Commissioners who would like to see this happen. We also strongly support the Dash 1 amendments that have been offered up by the Conservancy, and so we urge you to move this bill out of committee with the Dash 1 amendments with a due pass recommendation. Be happy to answer any questions, but really the presentations you've already heard kind of spell out the purpose of this bill.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else here? That's all the people on the list signed up for this bill. Seeing no one, thank you. We will close our public hearing on House Bill 2992, and we'll open a work session on 2992.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 1s into HB 2992.
Representative Boquist moves the Dash 1 amendments into 2992. Do I have any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And now I will entertain any discussion on the bill. Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote on the... Oh, I need a motion from you.
Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion that we move House Bill 2992 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Representative Smith has moved House Bill 2992 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I was trying to move fast. It was a long meeting last time. So, With that, any discussion? Okay, thanks. We'll have a roll call by our assistant.
Representative Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Glenn?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. It passes. Do we want to have? Would you like to carry this?
I'd rather consent calendar since. You know.
I think you should carry it.
I think you should carry it.
I object.
That does it.
Okay, I'd be happy to carry it.
Representative Dinkfelder.
I concur with Representative Smith. I think this is a great bill, and I think it deserves a little showcasing of the floor of the House.
There you go.
As long as my colleagues don't ask a lot of questions.
We're ready.
I have that feeling. They're sharpening their saw now.
Okay. We will now open a public hearing on 3188.
Yeah, that will always be easy to carry over.
Thank you. I know.
Okay.
We'll have a short explanation.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 3188 clarifies the authority of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries related to the permitting of oil or gas operations. The bill modifies definitions and establishes fees. There is no revenue impact. We've not received a fiscal statement, and there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. We have only two people, so Gary Lynch, you want to come up? And we could also have Gary Bauer come on up, I guess, as well, if you would like to. Let's see him here.
He was here.
He'll probably be back.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Lynch. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And I did talk to Gary Bauer. He has two hearings going on at the same time. I asked him if it would be okay to say what I think he would have said, and he said sure.
That's a good one.
I hope you're going to get paid his salary. That's all I can say.
I'm going through my notes here, but I wanted to start out talking about what this bill isn't. And this bill has no effect on LNG, and there is some confusion at times because of the word gas, I think. So this bill has no effect on that. In addition, you will always hear us refer, for some reason, to this as the oil and gas program. And that is true. However, to the best of my knowledge, there's never been any discovery of oil in this state. Now, I'm not a geologist. I work with a lot of them, and I trust their opinion, and I believe that's accurate. I would also, at this time, like to point out that we have Bob Houston is with me today, and our director is Dr. Vicki McConnell. When you look at Bob, you're looking at the oil and gas program for the state of Oregon. and I would be remiss if I didn't add that Don Marshall, our administrative assistant, is another key player in that, and about 25% of her time goes to that. So that is the oil and gas program for the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, I want to clarify that we do create biofuels, so we do create some oil here in the state.
Well, that's a good point. I don't
it's
know if it creates quite
It's not coming from down a hole, though, can I say.
We don't have to find it underground.
Yes, that's right.
And we actually produce fertilizer, too, from this stuff.
Right, exactly.
I would like to thank a lot of folks, and I'll just say that for now, because a lot of work has gone in on this bill. We started talking about this bill back in, we believe, 2005. Our governing board held their meeting in Coos Bay to talk about the Methane Energy Corporation drilling that was going on there, and it's a very promising new field of gas. In addition, we have a mature field up in Mist, which is in Columbia County, that's been producing gas since 1980, and it's produced about 70 billion cubic feet of gas. And I'll give you some way to try to put that into how much that means. But before I do that, I'd point out that if Methane Energy Corporation, they are estimating at this point of time that field down there could produce about 1.2 trillion cubic feet of gas. And how do you get a handle on that? Well, that, we believe, on our rough calculations, would support the 1.5 million households in Oregon, would supply their energy needs for 10 years. So this is an important bill in the standpoint that the oil and gas industry is expanding in Oregon, particularly with the Methane Energy Corporation. What hasn't expanded and what hasn't been updated are oil and gas rules and statutes. We haven't had a fee increase in that program since 1989, and in addition, in 2001, when we reorganized, we took the general fund out of that program. So we now have a situation where workload exceeds our revenue to support the staff doing the work. And we are working as best we can to make sure everything's covered, but we need help there now. To industry's credit, they have started, they worked with us, we started talking with them over a year ago about this very issue. And that's why we did have the governing board meeting in Coos Bay. We also, in January 29th, we held an evening public meeting to get the input from the folks in the community down there. I think it's safe, well, I know it's safe to say that industry supports the bill entirely. And I will say the bill didn't come out with legislative council quite the way we had hoped it would. And so we know we need to amend this bill to make everybody happy. But at least the industry has said we have proposed draft amendments, and industry has accepted those. And we haven't had a chance to distribute them to anybody else. However, this bill, as it is now, does almost everything we want it to do, and I can take a brief minute or two to explain that. And clearly, I think the thing that jumps out at anyone most might be the sticker shock on the size of the fee increase. But that fee increase was worked. We specifically sat down with the industry, said, here are the tasks that we must accomplish. We bill out at $50 an hour. We can do the math of what we need to support that program. It is based on workload, so revenue would rise and fall with the need to do work. It changes the number. It breaks things down and reorganizes things so wells are wells and holes are holes, and that's industry jargon that we need to clarify to make simpler. And we think not only will we then, if the fee increase and the bill is approved, we will have the money to properly regulate the site. And some of the things we need to do is definitely improve the environmental protection at these sites. Not that the industry hasn't done a good job, but without those standards and without making them part of the permit up front, without, as John Wooden said, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. So we need that addition. Also, because we haven't had a lot of activity since 91, we are out of date with our own Administrative Procedures Act. And this is a very straightforward change, but this will fix that. Also, as I mentioned, there is industry jargon and terminology unique to this industry. Terms like spacing units and discovery are very technical terms, and they mean something, and we need to clarify that so that the proper protection and make sure that the resource isn't wasted occurs, and industry is the first to jump on that one as well. The last thing I will mention that this bill does is it will definitely allow us the ability to coordinate with the other agencies that are involved in this. And that's very important, so that the state will speak with one voice and we get the interdisciplinary review we need. Those are the things that this bill will change, and change dramatically for the state of Oregon. I've talked to all the industry members, and I don't think Gary has made it back yet. If he has, he's welcome to come up here and join me. But there are only three companies involved in this state right now. They all support the fee increase. They all support the amendments, as at least we have drafted so far. I know you folks are busy, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. But I can conclude my testimony now with that.
Okay. And so we should expect the amendments in the next week or so?
I can have them tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
They're done. And I wanted to make sure that when we came to this hearing that now, in fairness, the folks that haven't seen it would be the folks in Coos Bay yet.
Right.
I think it's safe to say not everybody down there was in favor of this. An awful lot were. I got to give Methane credit. Methane Energy Corporation some credit, because the sentiment, the overriding sentiment I took away from that meeting was, well, we like Methane Energy Corporation. They're doing a great job. We're not sure we want anybody else in here. And I said, well, that's what good regulation will do. It'll help the good guys and punish the folks who aren't as good.
Yeah. I will say, having been at the meetings, I want to commend the department for being down there actively working with the citizens in our community and with this group. And I will say that I got the same, exactly the same read, is that this is a group we really like working for, but they're the guys that are coming in and exploring, and then they're going to leave, and who's going to have it afterwards? So they appreciate it. And I know the methane people were concerned. They felt they weren't paying enough when they were doing the work. So when they even mentioned that they wanted to help out, they made some of their own decisions early, which I think business has been choosing to do more and more, and that is understanding the issues that have been exposed in this industry with respect to water that they're getting out of the ground. They made the decision right off the bat that no water that they took out of the well was going to go into the streams. It was going to go down to a secondary treatment plant. I mean, they've done all the right kinds of things, and I think a lot of industry is working that way all the time. They don't get the credit for that. They wanted these regulations so that they were helping for that. So I appreciate that. We really can't do a work session until we get the amendments. But any other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question. Would the amendments then clean up the terminology? Is that what?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith. The main thing is to talk about, again, it gets confusing when you look at our current laws, what is a well versus what is a hole. And so it specifically addresses what is a well versus what is a hole. It also clarifies that on the holes, and holes are for information, and that they aren't as expensive for us to inspect as a well is. And so it separates and clears up the language. At one point, it was going to be we were going to charge $1,000 per hole. That was not our intent. It was to not exceed $1,000 per hole. But we have to tie it to workload, which we didn't do. So it fixes, I would say it's really as much as anything a housekeeping fix, but it is needed.
Okay, thank you.
Another question?
No, Mr. Chair, but just by oil and gas standards, I mean, the fees are not...
Right.
They're actually fairly low right now, even in this bill.
Even with this bill, yeah. And for people who don't know, this is coal bed methane, which is an interesting deal, and the whole process is fairly interesting to watch.
It is considered unconventional industry. And, Mr. Chairman, if I might, and I meant to say this earlier, I can't tell you how hard, excuse me, Bob Houston and Don Marshall have worked on this. And it's their relationship with the industry and also the citizens down there that I think have allowed this bill to go forward.
I appreciate that. Any other questions? Seeing them, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else wish to speak to this bill? Then we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2992, and we're...
3188.
Oh, that was 3188. Sorry, close the hearing on 3188. And we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3494. And we'll have a short explanation.
Mr. Chair, members, House Bill 3494 authorizes the Department of Agriculture to receive and distribute grant funds for any purpose related to the laws administered or enforced by the department. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral.
Thank you. And we have Lauren Henderson from the Oregon Department of Agriculture.
Curious to see what this is all about.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Lauren Henderson, Assistant Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I hope this is one of your easier bills to contemplate today. House Bill 3494 is nothing more than a housekeeping bill that the department worked on with Representative Krieger and Representative Boone. As a result of the department being the lead agency to provide grant assistance payments, cash payments to the fishers that were a result of the closure. I want to take this opportunity to thank Representative Krieger and Boone for their help not only with that program but also bringing this bill to you. As I had mentioned, during the course of the agency leading that effort, it was brought to our attention by the Department of Justice that they were uncertain, given the language that we had in 561, whether we really had clear authority to provide grant payments. And so this bill simply amends 561 and adds that ability to the department so that it's clear that the department can provide grant assistance payments.
And do you know anything of the dash ones?
There are dash ones, I believe, and they, I think, just make a few minor changes. One, we wanted to make sure that the Indian tribes in this state were included in that. We do work with them, as well as I think there was a section that is in bold that we needed to be taken out and replaced with what was already there.
Hey, any questions of this? Yes, Representative Boquist.
I'm assuming, Mr. Chair, that the we're also talking about intertransfer of grants between the agencies of the federal government, too. I see they're inserted in here along with the Indian tribes.
Representative Roblin, Representative Boquist, that's correct.
Okay, Mr. Chair, can you expand what types of grants are we talking about? And I don't vaguely remember 561.
Representative Roblin and Representative Boquist, the one that probably most people know about is we have currently today a lot of noxious weed grants that we issue. In this case, one of the issues that DOJ, I think, had the most uncertainty about was that for most of the work that we do, we issue grants and we get something back. In this case, with the grant assistance payments, they were assistance payments, and that's why they wanted us to provide a little more clarity that we could do that, and that is the primary purpose of this. Contracts and agreements, not a lawyer, but grants are a type of an agreement. They just wanted to make sure that if we had to give assistance payments like this in the future, that that word was inserted.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
I'm assuming we've been giving assistance payments in the past already, right?
Representative Roblin, Representative Boquist, to my knowledge, since I've been there, not quite like the Salmon Assistance Program. We have been giving grants in our programs today. The primary difference is that we expect a report or something back as part of those grant payments.
Well, look. And could you explain the Salmon Assistance Program a little bit, please?
Sure. Representative Roblin, Representative Boquist, the Salmon Assistance Program resulted out of the closure of the salmon trawler season off the coast. And as part of that, the governor issued $500,000, and the department came before the e-board at that time. I think it was in June for $500,000. And then subsequently to that, there was an e-board appropriation in September of an additional $500,000. As part of that, the department, being the lead agency, working with the Oregon Economic Community Development folks, put together a program that the salmon assistance in the first round, there were two rounds. The first round folks were asked to submit a form along with receipts and items so that we could reemplace their infrastructure expenses, boat mortgage fees, repairs, and those kinds of things. That was the first round. And then the second round was structured so that it was based on landing records with ODF&W, and then those payments were calculated off a percent of those landing records back out to the salmon fishers.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
And so then I'm assuming under the closure that the tribal entities that we received grants would have been subject to the same closures. Is that correct?
Representative Roblin, Representative Boquist, I can't answer that. I'm not sure.
We didn't
sure.
do any of this. No, there were no payments to other than commercial fishermen.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. That's why I'm wondering about the verbiage.
Oh. Well, I think I'll ask a question. So this allows you in the future, if, say, the federal government gave the state money to reimburse fishermen or tribes for whatever, you could go about doing that without having to come back here. If they gave you some money to grant to these other people.
Representative Roblin, Representative Boquist, I think today the way the federal government does their agreements, they do them in a cooperative agreement, not usually
okay.
a grant. And so by that, we would have the ability to do that already okay. through the cooperative agreements.
Well, Mr. Chair, my question's unanswered simply because there's two types of, as I recollect from testimony in the last session, and maybe senior members more educated than I am, but there are two types of seasons. And so if you have a closure on one, for example, then a normal non-tribal member may be eligible under this program. The only clarification I'm seeking is that I don't think we would be in a position to be giving a tribal entity or a tribal member a grant unless their season was closed in addition. And so I think the insert lacks clarity, Mr. Chair.
Representative Roble and Representative Boquist, in the last Salmon Assistance Program, there were criteria that were developed for if anyone fit that criteria, they were eligible. And one of those is that they had to have a current, they had to be Oregon resident, and they had to possess a current permit from ODFNW. So I would assume if a tribal entity had a permit as a salmon troller, they would have been allowed a payment under that. We did not have that in this last program.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I may be mistaken, but I believe even in the permitting process, they could still have a permit and they would have an allocation, whereas a normal commercial fisherman may not have an allocation.
Representative Roblin and Representative Boquist, I'm not sure, since the program was based on landings, if the criteria were different, that is possible.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, my only concern is making sure that apples and apples and oranges here.
Yeah, and I guess the other question you're saying is, with respect to our previous program, this dash one amendment was not necessary at all. Is that correct?
Chair Roblin, Representative Boquist, it was not even contemplated. Okay. I do not, so I don't know.
Okay, Mr. Chair, follow-up question?
Yeah.
I think I would, I mean, I'm uncomfortable unless someone can fully explain from DOJ how we got to this particular. I'm not necessarily opposed to it, but it just seems ironic or unexplainable why we need this language in here when it actually is involving the intertwining of state and a tribal nation state. And we've not previously tampered too much across boundaries. And if you recall, even on the Buffalo Bill, we brought the issue up of, you know, there's a tribal entity and a tribal entity has its own governing laws and we have our own second set of governing laws. And how does this intermesh with that? And why does the Department of Justice think we need to have this verbiage?
Yes.
Chair Roblin, Representative Boquist, I think today, since the tribes are considered government-like, that our agency, if we have an agreement with them for various purposes, noxious weed being something that comes, it actually is an intergovernmental type agreement instead of a grant agreement.
Mr. Chair, I mean, that's correct, but it's not another government entity. It's an independent nation under the Constitution, which makes it an interstate pact versus a intrastate pact.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I don't have an answer.
Okay. We might want to ask that question. Okay. Any other questions?
I'm afraid to. No. I just wanted to ask, but thank you, Mr. Chair. How did this come apart? Why do they think they need the authority? They didn't have it before, and they gave out the money?
Yep.
Chair Roblin, Representative Smith, we did not, our agency did not, because of the uncertainty, did not actually make the payments. We administered the program and used the Oregon Economic Community Development Department to actually make the payments.
Okay.
And having been there and watched all of it happen, the people were very comfortable with the program being administered by the Department of Ag.
I'm sure.
They were not necessarily comfortable with somebody else doing it, but Ag couldn't do the whole program because of this particular situation. So they administered the program and then sent it to somebody else to distribute the money. And that was the reason for this bill, so they could do all of it.
So now we're going back and
saying now if it ever happens again, they can do it themselves.
Okay.
So that follow-up, Mr. Chair, and you may not know the question, but I think it is a good question to ask. Does economic development have the same nation state? Have the Indian tribes pushed into their language, which allow them to do it now? Or where exactly does that fit? And to me, I mean, again, I don't have a problem with this. It's just that it's a tampering of legal issues.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Seeing none, thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on 3494, and we will get some answers before we have a work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's why we have public hearings. So we will open a public hearing on 3434, a bill that we've had a public hearing scheduled for in the past and haven't been able to get to. So appreciate the chance we're going to get to today. So I'll let our administrator give a brief explanation.
Mr. Chair and members, House Bill 3434 directs the State Land Board to adopt a management plan for the Elliott State Forest that ensures a rate of return at or above the rate received by the Oregon Investment Council for the Common School Fund. The bill requires the sale of the Elliott if the rate of return does not match or exceed the OIC rate during calendar years 2008 through 2010 and directs that the proceeds from the sale to be placed in the Common School Fund. The bill may have both a revenue and fiscal impact, and there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. And our first person will be our own Representative Burley.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members, and thank you very much for this hearing. I am Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54. And, Mr. Chair, if I may, before I start, I want to give you just a brief background so you understand why I feel so strongly about this matter. I am a certified forester. I have 2 degrees in forest and natural resource management. Early in my professional career, I spent 10 years with the U.S. Forest Service, and since 1990, I've worked here in Oregon for the private forest products industry. And, Mr. Chair, there's going to be witnesses after me that are going to tell you the details of this bill, what its intent is, and others, I'm sure, will probably testify how bad the bill is, and perhaps even that it has constitutional issues. But what I want to focus on here is a broader issue, and that's the importance of forest lands to our state's economy. It doesn't matter if we're talking about biomass, managing border forestry lands like Tillamook and Clatsop, or managing the common school lands like the Elliott or Sun Pass forests. There is always pushback because of other values that I don't dispute. These include recreation, clean water, wildlife habitat, and all the other important resource values that our forest lands provide. But the fact of the matter is, these forest lands provide a renewable natural resource that can be managed at a sustainable level and provide not only the resource values that I mentioned before, but also provide quality jobs and revenue for schools and roads. The forest products industry is a basic industry, and what this means is it converts natural resources, in this case timber, into consumer products, lumber, panels, paper, other types of forest products, and these products are sold for the most part outside the state of Oregon. This value-added process is how wealth is created and contributes to our state's economy. For a long time, this industry helped fund our schools and local roads, among other things, through the 25% federal timber receipts and payments from state lands. This fact has never been more apparent than today, as evidenced by the mad scramble our counties face to replace these lost revenues. It is my opinion that we need to be self-sustaining and not look to Washington, D.C. for handouts. And, Mr. Chair, in our Capitol clips today, there was an article from the Bend Bulletin. The headline says, Area Braces for Future with No Timber Subsidy. And I think, Mr. Chair, it's our responsibility to avoid ever seeing headlines like this again. Managing our forests responsibly can help move us in that direction. Now, in the case of the Common School Fund, about 80% of the revenue into the fund comes from forest management on the common school lands. We should not be ashamed of this fact, but instead we should work to improve the performance of these lands. That is what this bill focuses on. If this bill is not enacted, I certainly hope that our policymakers and the executive branch recognize the importance of these lands and how, when properly managed, they can provide quality family wage jobs and generate revenue for our common school fund. So again, Mr. Chair, thank you for this hearing. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Yes, questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have Louise Soliday and Jim Paul.
Good job.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Louise Soliday, the director of the Department of State Lands. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3434. As we understand the provisions of House Bill 3434, it would require the department working with our agency partner, the Department of Forestry, to develop a forest management plan to manage the Elliott State Forests in a way that would equal or exceed the return rate of return that we get on our equity investments in the Common School Fund, and that if those rates were not achieved in 2008, 2009, and 2010, that we would have to offer the forest for sale through a bid process. There are the provisions of this bill raise a number of issues for us, but before I get into that, I want to talk about what we are doing to try and improve harvests on the Elliott State Forest, because I think we share the fundamental concerns that folks are expressing about management of the Elliott State Forest. We have been working along with the Department of Forestry on development of a multi-species habitat conservation plan for the Elliott State Forest. We have currently have two listed species that use the forest, and those are northern spotted owls and marbled murrelets. And in the past, coho salmon have also been listed. They are currently not listed. And we have several other species that are at risk, that have been identified at risk by either the National Marine Fisheries Service, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, or the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And so the goal is to get a 60-year habitat conservation plan in place to cover the currently listed species as well as those that have been identified as at-risk species. We are nearing the end of that process. There is a draft environmental impact statement that's being finalized that we expect to be out on the streets later this year, in fact, within the next couple of months, for public review and comment. We have an HCP that's been drafted. We've been in conversations with both of the services about that and are feeling cautiously optimistic that we are going to be successful in this effort. We believe that development of the habitat conservation plan is the best way to provide long-term sustainable harvest from the Elliott State Forest in this day and age when we've got endangered species act listed species in the forest. Under the HCP, we believe that we can harvest 40 million board feet per year on a sustainable level for the next 60 years from the forest. Only once in recent memory have we harvested more than 40 million board feet, and that was back in the year 2000. So that would get us to a fairly high level compared to the levels of harvest that have been coming off of that forest historically. The bill, as it's crafted, raises a number of concerns for us. First of all, it would be difficult to develop a forest management plan to meet a rate of return, which we don't know, because as I understand it, we're supposed to meet the rate of return for 2008, 2009, 2010, and it's a little hard. So we don't know what the rate of return is. But to put that into some historical context, I've attached a chart to my testimony which gives you the last 10 years of Common School Fund returns so that you sort of get the range of returns that we've had over the last 10 years. And they go from a low of minus 11.15% in 2002 to a high of plus 24.72% in 2004. So the range is, as you would anticipate when you're invested in volatile securities, is fairly wide. The average, the 10-year average, as you can see, is 8.71%, and our management target is actually 8%, and so we're exceeding our management target over the long term for the investment of those funds. We're very concerned about tying a rate of return for the Elliott State Forest to the rate of return for dissimilar types of investment securities. We do not believe that that is a good fiduciary responsibility on the part of the land board, and would be very concerned about doing that, given that it is a totally different kind of investment that we would be trying to compare the Elliott State Forest returns to. I also want to point out that it is the harvest
revenues from the Elliott State Forest that actually allowed us to make distributions to schools during the down market years in 2002 to 2003, because it was the revenue that went into the distributable income account that we have, which is the basis on which we make those distributions. And had we not had harvest from the Elliott State Forest distribution, we would not have had money in the distributable account. So for us, it's a buffer against our market investments and allows us to make those distributions. It's important to point out that the department has been working in recent years to diversify the real estate portfolio that we manage for the Common School Fund. We have about 2.3 million acres of lands that we manage across the state of Oregon. A large portion of those are forest lands and agricultural lands and range lands that were the original trust lands, or lands that we've exchanged from those original trust lands that we received. But we are trying to diversify that real estate portfolio in an effort to increase the revenues that we are generating from the real estate portion of our portfolio by picking up lands that we believe over time will be available for industrial, commercial, and residential development. And many of those parcels that we are picking up are as a result of our what are called our in-lieu land selections, where we are still trying to get land that we were supposed to receive at statehood, and we are picking up those parcels of land in Central Oregon and the Bend, Redmond area, where we believe growth is going to continue to occur and opportunities to develop those parcels for ongoing industrial, commercial, and residential revenues are going to occur. Finally, we do believe, and I think Representative Burley referred to this, we do believe that this bill does raise a constitutional issue. It is the Constitution under Article 8, Section 5, that gives the land board the exclusive authority to manage the trust lands. They are the trustees of the trust, and it is their responsibility and their responsibility alone to make the management decisions for those Common School Fund trust lands across the state. And so we do have concerns about whether this bill is consistent with the Constitution of Oregon. With that, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 3434. Jim Paul is here from the Department of Forestry, and as I think everybody knows, we are in an interagency agreement with the Department of Forestry, who manages most of our forest lands for us so that we don't have multiple agencies doing forest management in the state of Oregon. They're the experts. We are not. And so Jim is going to talk a little bit about what we've done is looked at if we manage to an 8.71% return, since that's the average over the 10 years, what would that mean in terms of the Elliott State Forest, to sort of put this in some context for you. With that, thanks.
Thanks, Louise. Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Paul, Assistant State Forester for the Forest Management Division with the Department of Forestry. And as Louise mentioned, we have done a rough analysis of what this would mean in terms of management of the Elliott. Before I get into that, I did want to just talk briefly about sort of the history and a little bit of context around the management of the Elliott. As Louise mentioned, we have to go pretty far back to find a year where we did harvest more than 40 million board feet. We'd have to go back to the 80s to get there. We're actually up to around 50 million board feet up until the listing of the Northern Spotted Owl in 1991. At that time, we saw our harvest levels drop down to 10 million board feet, and because our knowledge of the spotted owl at that time was relatively little compared to what we know today, there was some concern it may drop even further to 5 million in terms of practicing take avoidance. At that time, we decided to pursue an HCP in 1995. We did adopt an HCP, which is still in effect today. That increased our harvest levels up to 27 million board feet on average. We have been able to, there's been some variability around that number, but on average we've been able to maintain that. Also, as Louise mentioned, we're looking at negotiations under a new HCP where we believe we could reach harvest levels as high as 40 million board feet. Under the current HCP, we've also done an analysis of what kind of rate of return we think we could achieve. Currently, we believe we're achieving about a just under 3% rate of return. Under the HCP, we believe we could reach up to a 4 and 4.5% rate of return. One thing Louise didn't mention is the recent asset management plan adopted by the land board that does shoot for a goal of returns between 3 and 5% for the forest lands. I think a key piece of the HCP, as Louise referred to, is a sustainable and predictable supply of timber. The Elliott, about half of the Elliott forest lands is an 85-year-old age class or greater. That age class does provide suitable habitat for critters such as the northern spotted owl and the marbled murrelet. So we have real T&E issues on the Elliott State Forest that we do need to deal with. Getting to the issue of what it would take to achieve an 8.71% return, using a range of really a lot of that hinges on how you value the forest. We did have a recent contract where we tried to do that, get at what a value would be, and we got a range of values in that contract. Using that range, we estimate that we would need to increase harvest levels to somewhere between 72 million and 88 million board feet per year. That level of harvesting, in the short term, it's possible to achieve that level of harvest. However, because of the uncertainty around T&E species and when you might run into one and when that might encumber a sale, it's difficult to say for what duration we could maintain that. Even if there were no T&E species issues, some of our recent modeling has shown that that level of harvesting could not be maintained over the long term, meaning looking out 50 to 100 years, the forest is not likely to be able to maintain that based on our most current information. In closing, I think I would just like to reiterate some of Louise's points. We are in agreement that currently we do need a change in the way we're approaching the management of the Elliott. As I said, that we are still able to achieve about 27 million board feet. However, looking out a couple of years, we are seeing the likelihood of that harvest level diminishing over time because primarily of T&E species, and that is why we are pursuing this HCP so aggressively. In our minds, we're not looking at the new HCP or the status quo. We're really looking at we need to get this HCP in place, and if we are not able to within a year or two, we are going to need to be looking at an alternative approach to managing the Elliott. So with that, I'll close my comments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions for you.
Questions? Representative Clem.
You can jump in first, Brian Squared.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I got the numbers right. So yes. With the HCP, if it's accepted at what we're proposing and then it ends up at 40 million board feet, that rate of return was then 4% or 3 to 4%?
Chair Relvin, Representative Clem, we estimate it'll land us between 4 and 4.5%.
4 and 4.5. Yeah. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And the timeline on this HCP approval is sort of unknown, isn't it? Or is there a range when we might have an answer?
Right now we estimate it's going to be the spring or summer of next year at the soonest where we would get to that agreement. And as I referred to earlier, we're about 2 years out from now, we will be seeing diminished opportunities on the Elliott for harvesting, so we are in the beginnings of thinking of a contingency plan. In other words, not sort of letting that process drag on. If it does drag on, that if we are not able to bring closure to that, we will start looking at alternatives.
And one more follow-up. Yeah. And I'm just trying to remember details of the bill. The bill calls for, and during the 2008 to 2010 period, that it would need to basically hit what traditionally has been 8.71%. So we're talking about maybe getting to half of that. So it would almost guarantee the sale of the forest is what you're telling me in essence. If the bill passed, it almost virtually assured the forest would be sold.
Chair Roblin, Representative Clem, maybe the best way to put that is that if we look to our management agreement and the mandate of these lands that says we need to practice a management plan, implement a management plan that produces a sustainable, even flow of harvest, it would be very difficult to create a management plan that we could say would do that were this bill to pass.
got one more question, but maybe we should take another one, see if that he might ask it already.
Representative Boakley.
Thank you, Chair. Can either one of you tell me what the rate of return is on the on most of the Treasury bonds that the state treasurer manages?
Mr. Chair and Representative Boakley, I cannot. That would be a good question for Representative Burley.
Well, Mr. Chair, my reason for the question is, if we're trying to establish what a rate of return is for good public policy and investment, and this is a timberland that's supposed to be managed the common school fund for the best investment, we should be comparing what the state treasurer already gets on the bond rate, for example, the management of PERS, and what the rate of return of that is to establish what a market rate of return would be for the value of a $265 million forest. And if the rate of return is higher than 3 or 4%, then it begs to differ. Are we managing the forest for that? And I think my follow-on question to that, Mr. Chair, would be, what's the cost per million board foot for the Department of Forestry to manage this forest?
Chair Roblin, Representative Boakley, I can answer that question in this way. We do have numbers in terms of our five-year average in terms of revenues to the gross revenues to the Common School Fund, and I believe it's around $13 million. We have recently looked at the revenue produced, value of the timber coming off of all of Common School Forest lands relative to our expenses of all of Common School Forest lands, and we found that 90% of the value is coming off of the Elliott. And it's only incurring about 70% of the cost. And what that results in on a five-year average is about a 28% cost-to-revenue ratio. Now, on the rest of the lands, we think we're only about breaking even. In other words, we're at about 100% cost-to-revenue ratio. So in terms of the issue of making sure we're managing these lands as best we can, I guess in my opinion, the Elliott is, in fact, probably performing relatively well for forest lands, but we do have other parcels that we recognize are not performing very well.
I'll let the good representative on my left go next. She'll come back to me.
Sure. Thank you. Well, I'm following up on a question that Representative Boakley just asked. And since we're reviewing your budget right now in Ways and Means, I don't want you to panic. But the question that I have is, and I'm looking at, we had an information session. This is dated March 13th. It's in my file from your boss, the state forester, Mr. Brown. And we had some discussion about looking at the historical harvest levels and expenditures for the district. And I don't know if you recall that that chart, but we did talk about what the fixed costs were. I mean, part of the problem is that we've had, basically the amount of revenue that's come off the forest recently with the development of the HCP has gone down, but the fixed costs, it appears, have remained the same, and that's part of, I guess, the challenge is that we have ODF that's managing it. Well, you know, we have another agency that's owns it and has the state lands, the state land board has the authority to set the rate of return. So I don't know if at all, you know, part of what comes to mind, of course, is saying maybe we should contract out these positions. And I mean, we still need to have foresters there, even if we're not harvesting at the same levels. But part of the challenge is, I don't know if I'm explaining this really well, but in my mind, you know, we're letting people off or letting people go. We still have a number of FTEs, both in the regional office and in Salem, that this is supporting. And so if you have any comments on that and ways we can reduce the costs so we actually are, you know, more than breaking even, even in bad, you know, or low harvest years. So I'm not being very clear with that, but I think that's part of the challenge in looking at your budget. You have a certain number of FTEs that are supported by managing this forest.
Chair Roblin, Representative Dingfelder, that's correct. And it's important to know that in terms of the management plan for the Elliott and of all of our forests, we manage on an acreage basis. So we try to consistently harvest the same number of acres every year. And we do that by putting out sales on a certain number of acreage. So to staff, when you're managing lands in that way, that essentially you need about the same level of staff continuously over time to put out those sales, to do the groundwork, to do the surveys, to manage the contracts. In 2006, we did have a very bad year. It may have been the worst year in recent memory. And we found that a large part of that was because of some very unusual market conditions where the wood just was not moving. So we had the same staff we've been maintaining over time. We posted the same number of sales that would cover the same amount of acreage. But for some reason, the purchasers of those sales simply did not exercise their contract that year as we anticipated. We are seeing somewhat of a rebound this year. But yes, our costs are relatively fixed, and if you look at them over time, you don't see any real dramatic increases or decreases. There's a fairly steady increase. It's really the revenues that you see fluctuate over a short period of time, and that's pretty typical in terms of the forest management business, and that's one reason why we always try to look at a 5-year, 3 to 5-year, even a 10-year average to assess performance and try not to focus on any single year in terms of evaluating how well the plans are performing.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, if I can add to that, I think one of the conversations we'll have with the department now that they've sort of teased out this data in terms of cost of the Elliott versus revenue from the Elliott and cost of all the other forest lands that they manage for us relative to the revenues is whether we should continue to manage those other forest lands. I mean, I think that's a very legitimate question under the current arrangement that we have with the Department of Forestry. As part of our asset management plan, we've identified about 12,000 acres of scattered forest lands around the state that we're likely to offer for sale over the next 10 years because they are expensive to manage without a lot of revenue coming into the Common School Fund from them. And I think we'll continue to do that over the long term to try and identify lands that are not productive, that have costs associated with them, and to dispose of them and reinvest those dollars in lands that are going to provide better return to us. So I do think we'll have that conversation about we certify a number of acres that the department manages for us periodically, and I think we'll be having a conversation about whether the number of acres that we have certified right now for them to manage is the right number. They don't manage 100% of our forest lands now, and so I think it's a good conversation for us to have now that we've taken a look at these cost to revenue figures in some detail.
Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up to that, just so I understand. Louise, is it statutory requirement that the Department of State Lands, you know, uses the Department of Forestry foresters, or is it a memorandum of agreement that you have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I believe the statute is permissive. It says that we may use the Board of Forestry, the Department of Forestry, to manage our lands. And I think the may is there to overcome the constitutional issue of who's got authority to make management decisions. So, but I think the intent, the legislative intent clearly was to use the Department of Forestry so that we were not creating our own forestry staff and managing forest lands when we already had a department that did that in the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm having a struggle with the language of the bill, as it refers to a rate of return on the Elliott State Forest, but a rate of return is simply dollars that you receive divided by a capital value. And I'm wondering, is what is that capital value? I heard a reference to several hundred million dollars, but is there an assigned capital value? Do you go through a valuation process and get and find out what the marketplace would fetch if you were to put it on the auction block?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, we do periodically do an appraisal of many of our real estate assets. The most recent appraisal, and I can't remember the year it was done. To you, Jim?
2005.
Okay, so we have a fairly current appraisal that had it in the range of $250 million to $450 million, so it's a fairly wide range in terms of value.
Follow up, if I could, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Most sophisticated appraisal techniques are a multiplier of earnings. That is, that capital value is a function of what is actually being yielded by the property. So, it strikes me as a little circular. That is, it's what the yield is, or maybe what the potential yield is off the property that is driving that capital value. Any comments on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, we are struggling with the way this bill is crafted also because of those sorts of issues. It's
it would be very difficult for us to develop a management plan with an unknown target that's out there somewhere, not knowing what the value of the forest is, not knowing what the revenue is going to be off of those forests.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We have a number of other people. I will have a question with Mr. Clem and a question with Representative Clem and a question with Representative Bulbas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I can take a brief answer because I think probably an industry person might be better to answer my question. But, what I'm really interested in isn't so much how you would compare to a dissimilar investment vehicle, but really what happens when someone who has a threatened or endangered species right nearby, how do they manage theirs? Because that's really the better comparison for me. And I remember in Ways and Means we talked about this, and I am a little concerned that possibly private industry who has the same exact issues, same take avoidance strategies required under the law, at least that's my perception, same exact things, still are able to somehow get more board feet and meet the law. And I don't know if that's they have HCPs in effect or what, but no, I don't think we should compare it to the Treasury. No, I don't think we should compare it to the Investment Council. Yes, I think we should compare it to the neighbors who also operate under the same program.
Mr. Chair and Representative yes. Clem, I'll take a stab at that. I think one of the things that it's important to note is that the Elliott is a fairly older forest in terms of the age of the trees that we have in that forest, and as a result, because we have late cereal forests there, owls and murrelets like it. I think if you look at the forests that are surrounding the Elliott State Forest, they are younger forests. They are managed on have been managed on shorter rotations. So to say that to manage a take avoidance strategy on the Elliott State Forest and to manage a take avoidance strategy on private industrial or the county lands that surround the Elliott State Forest is not really comparing the same thing. It's the same take avoidance strategy, but you have two different forests in terms of the structure of the forest. We've got habitat that the owls and murrelets like, and therefore we are finding owls and murrelets in particular just about everywhere we look, and it makes you not want to look at some point, but that's the reality. And so we've got a forest that's attractive to those critters. Murrelets are there part of the year, owls are there longer periods of time, but it's the same strategy in terms of a survey and manage, but you got a different forest that you're dealing with.
Representative Bookman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my first question is to go back to a statement the Forestry Department made. Did I hear you correctly in saying that the market rates per million board foot in 2006 were down? Is that what you said?
Chair Roblin, Representative Oquist, no. What I had said was that the market conditions of 2006 were relatively unique in that the purchases of our sales that year, a large number of them chose not to exercise the contract that year and harvest that wood. They chose to wait. The contracts on state forest lands, we typically give 3 years. We provide 3 years for a purchaser of a contract to actually go out and harvest the wood and haul the wood away. And as we said, the department, that the wood wasn't moving that year. And you can't always explain why. We looked up and down the coast in other markets, and we weren't seeing that same phenomenon in other markets that year. It was something, it was an anomaly that occurred apparently in the Elliott area, the Coos Bay area.
As a follow-up then, Mr. Chair, I mean, the market conditions are actually very good for the private sector, which therefore means if it was a lower-cost sale, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that if you can take lower-value state wood and harvest it the next year, that you're going to make a higher level of profit. It's not like a market anomaly. Back to a reference that was made, Mr. Chair, to Representative McPherson, I think he's absolutely correct that when you start analyzing values in timberland or anything, you look at the rate of return. And if you'll notice in the documentation, there's a rate of return somewhere between, or value of the forestation based on between $265 million and $489 million. And if you, doesn't, I've done enough appraisals of timber, and there's foresters in here that can later testify to this, that I think, in fact, if you look at the present rate of return, you'll have the low end. If you look at the potential rate of return that a merger acquisition or someone issuing a line of credit was, you're going to see a span between this $250 and $400 million. And that's all fairly common practice in the business sector. And the concern I have, you know, is not necessarily the language in the bill, but the fact of the matter is that we have a spread of $200 million indicates that there is someone, even an appraiser hired by the state of Oregon, that's saying that we're not getting the right rate of return. And when we can't identify at the forestry level the cost per million board foot of managing it, it's fairly obvious to me that we're looking at a situation where we even ought to consider selling the forest, in fact, and investing the money with Randall Edwards, you know, and getting a higher rate of return, because that's the intent of this property. Or else we need to fire the Oregon Department of Forestry and hire somebody else that can provide the management skills that are out there. Because this, unlike a national forest or like a state park, I mean, there's a specific task and goal in mind. And the fact that we've failed to date is exactly why this bill is sitting here before us. And lastly, Mr. Chair, I mean, there's a scientific fact that old owls will fly out of old growth timber into younger growth timber, and that was put to rest scientifically up in the state of Montana. So I just have real concerns about the entire management from the Oregon Department of Forestry of this, and real concerns, and I'm not even a budgeteer, but what little I know about their budget leaves some real serious questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I guess the only question I have is, do we know how many board feet is being produced each year on the Elliott in general terms, regardless of all the other stuff, just how much wood is growing there?
Senator Roland, do you mean how much inventory we have, what type of volume we're putting on every year?
Yeah. How much grows every year in the Elliott Forest?
We do have a method for estimating that. Yes, we can calculate that.
Right. Do you know that offhand?
I do not know that offhand, but I can get that information.
Okay. I would like to know that. Okay. Thank you. Thank you both. We have a number of people. We'll start with John Charles from the Cascade Policy Trust. And then we have a guest on the phone after that one, and then we have a group of about six more people. I think we will make it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan policy research center working to promote individual liberty, economic opportunity, and personal responsibility. And although it's, of course, customary to thank you for the opportunity to speak, in my particular case, I've waited 12 years for this hearing, so I'm a lot happier to be here than I am for most other hearings. And I'll say that by kind of getting into how I even got interested in this issue, which I started in 1995. And I should say, first of all, I'm not a I don't have two degrees in forestry like Representative Burley. I don't cut trees for a living. I don't live near the Elliott State Forest. I live out in Clackamas County near Brightwood. I don't conduct recreation in the Elliott. I don't own stock in timber companies. I have no particular financial vested interest in this outcome, except, like many people in Oregon, I have family. In this, my case, I have two of my three grandchildren go to Portland Public Schools. And so they benefit when our assets of the Common School Fund perform well and checks are cut twice a year. And so that's my interest, is just in seeing this is well managed. Now, in 1995, I was working for the Oregon Environmental Council, and as such, which I did for a long time, I received this draft asset management plan, this thick document, just randomly because I was on the mailing list. And this was the first ever asset management plan for the Elliott. And that's when I learned about this thing called the Common School Trust Lands, that have been dedicated to raising revenue for schools since start of Oregon. And the asset management plan said flat out a number of things that concerned me, and I got interested, and I ended up writing a paper, which I've recently updated, and a copy is attached to my testimony. And it became clear to me that the Elliott was underperforming, and so I suggested that it maybe be sold. And for 12 years, through different governors, treasurers, management at the DSL, there's never really been a serious consideration of that. So I really appreciate that this bill is forward, is at least a vehicle, it's a placeholder for a discussion. The basic thrust of my analysis is just simply a reminder that the Elliott State Forest is part of the Common School Trust land, and therefore it is not like many other public lands in Oregon, multiple use lands, where sort of all kinds of discussions can come forward about the vision for it, and it's a big political mash. No, there is really only one purpose, and the Attorney General in 1992 in Oregon made very clear there is only one purpose for these lands, and that is maximize revenue for the common schools over the long term. And so we have to focus on that, and the Oregon Land Board has a fiduciary responsibility to ensure that that constitutional mandate is met. Now, several people have mentioned today, what is an appropriate benchmark? I've been involved in natural resource policy for 30 years professionally, and many, many times, bills, statutes, they sort of pick numbers out of thin air. Well, 50% this, recycling rate of this, renewable resource, new renewable energy of this, and they just pick them out of thin air. Here, we're lucky. We don't have to be arbitrary. There's several ways of looking at this. One is, and they've both been raised here today, how do surrounding lands, public and private, the Elliott, how do they comply with ESA, Clean Water Act, et cetera? What kind of timber is harvested? Second is, what's the rate of return in the Common School Fund, or actually all the funds of $70 billion that the Oregon Investment Council manages, Oregon PERS and many others, compared? And what's interesting is, as far back as 1995 in this report, what was noted by DSL in that plan was the statement that I'm quoting: over the past 20 years, the fund's financial investments, that is cash, equities, and bonds, have consistently obtained above-market rates of return. Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for the financial performance of the real property portion of the CSF portfolio. Overall, these assets have been consistently underperforming in terms of contribution to the Common School Fund, particularly in comparison to the returns obtained by the state treasurer's investment pool. Net revenue for most real estate assets has been declining. Well, that was 20 years of underperformance through 1995. It's now 2007. So over 30 years, regardless of who's governor, regardless of who's running the show, consistent underperformance. I think that's a problem when it comes to fiduciary responsibility. Apparently, again, according to records from DSL and DOF, this is largely because of the Endangered Species Act, although not exclusively. Again, they quoted back in 1995, largely due to costs associated with protecting endangered species, expenditures incurred by DOF and management of these lands has increased significantly over the past 9 years, reducing net revenues to the Common School Fund. The ratio of expenses to revenues has increased consistently during the study period, increasing by 1 percentage point annually on average. And the trend is expected to continue. Sure enough, it has continued. Revenue doesn't go up very much or declines. And I note in my paper here that I have a chart in there that shows how the net revenue keeps declining because the cost of doing business for DOF keeps rising. And muralets is primarily the problem. Now, there is an alternative strategy, and surprising to me, at least, which is why I'm interested, is that DOF knows about this because they contracted with the late John Buter in 1994 to look at all their management plans, and he concluded by saying selling the Elliott is the only marketing alternative likely to significantly increase net annual income to the Common School Fund. And I've attached to my testimony 4 pages of that with the relevant part highlighted. That advice apparently was ignored. The CSF has grown in value despite fluctuations in the market for a couple of bad years. The rate of return has, as Ms. Holliday noted, averaged over 8% for the last 10 years. And when I brought this up, I've been with this land board. And in June, I testified in front of the land board, and they made the argument that you've heard today. Well, real estate is an important thing that we should keep in our portfolio. It's good for asset diversity. Well, that's great if that is actually making a lot of money for you. But it's not. And again, you say, well, compared to what? But look at the state treasurer's annual report. Which I have. The Oregon Investment Council does own real estate on behalf of their various clients, such as public employees and their pensions, and their returns are phenomenal. For their $2.6 billion in the PERF Real Estate Investment Fund has a 5-year annualized average return of 18%. They also have $753 million within PERF is invested in real estate investment trusts, REITs. Their five-year annualized average return has been 26.5%. Meanwhile, the Elliott gets about 2 to 3% return on asset value. I think that's a very relevant piece of information that we have to consider in terms of fiduciary responsibility. So I'd like to close by saying that the bill, as drafted, does not mandate that the Elliott be sold. It simply sets a time period, which could be amended, to be compared with the returns on the common school fund, and that if they're not, if they don't measure up, you simply take bids to see what the value is really worth. Now, obviously, if the bid was low, it would be silly to sell. You shouldn't mandate to sell, but I think mandating to taking bids would solve one of the problems referenced by a previous legislator saying, well, how do you know how to value this? And, of course, it's a function of your management strategy and what you think you would get off it. Back in 1995, in this report, the state estimated that Elliott was worth $850 million. That was their published figure. Today, they're estimating it's worth about less than half that. But if you, as witnesses behind me, will, who know much more about this than I do, will say that if you were going to bid on it, if you thought the state would actually sell it and you knew how to comply with the ESA and the take-avoidance strategy, it might be worth $1 billion or up. One advantage of taking bids is that you finally answer the question, what is the asset worth? And it's interesting that there's a growing trend now in public sector to look at asset monetization is the buzz phrase, which is to convert public assets into some kind of private ownership to take the money now. And last year, the state of Indiana leased, not sold, but leased its 157-mile state toll road through 2081 to a private vendor. And before that, the published estimates was that the highway might be worth $2 billion. The actual value when they leased it was $3.8 billion. That money is now benefiting the citizens of Indiana. So I think, regardless of the constitutional issues, which I think are solvable, my view is you can wait for the ship to come home here, but after 30 years of underperforming by any measure, it's not about sort of who's running the show. There's something institutional in nature that leads to consistent underperforming, and I don't think it's going to change. And so I think it's a shame to me that the revenues benefit our children, school children, but nobody seems to speak up for them. But you can, and I hope you do. The only way to know what revenue should be coming off of this is to subject it to a market test, and I hope you do. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Question.
Representative.
You're looking for comparing values or comparing returns, and what Social Security, when we, you know, what has Social Security returned over the last 50 years? 2%. So maybe we could use that as a
comparison.
I think I've taken up enough time.
Thank you.
So what I had to say, thanks a lot, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed it.
Do we have the number?
What?
Oh, yeah. We're going to go hear from Francis Etherington, Umpqua Watersheds, on the phone. Hello?
Hello.
Yeah. This is Representative Roblin, the Chair of Ag and Natural Resources. You're in our committee hearing now. And is this
Francis?
Francis? Okay. Thanks, Francis. So you can begin your testimony. Be sure and explain who you are, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak today. And thank you very much. Oh, can you hear me?
We can. Very good.
Oh, and is the Oh, I see. It's a little time delay there. Okay. Well, thank you for the opportunity also to watch today's hearing from Roseburg using live streaming video. I really appreciate the opportunity to participate in this hearing in this way. My organization, Umpqua Watersheds, works for the protection and restoration of the Umpqua, Coos, and Coquille watersheds in southern Oregon. We have taken an interest in the Elliott State Forest Project since about 2002, and we are participating in the public process for the development of the new habitat conservation plan. I am speaking in opposition to House Bill 3434, which appears to just an attempt to increase logging in the Elliott, so much so that other non-timber values are jeopardized. Now, as you heard from previous testimony, the Elliott is a very important and unique forest, not only for its contributions to the common school fund lands, but also for wildlife habitat and for recreation. The Elliott contains trees older than any other state forest and also older than any of the surrounding private lands around the Elliott. Over half of the Elliott contains these older forests, and so therefore it is a real haven for, you know, the imperiled species such as the marble millet, northern spotted owl, and numerous species of salmon, which is why the Elliott got an HCP to begin with. The Elliott is also one of the most popular recreation areas on the southern Oregon coast. It adjoins the Dean Creek Elk Viewing Area, and it includes the shoreline of Loon Lake. It is close to Winchester Bay, very popular place, and it also is very close to the Silver and Golden Falls State Park. The Elliott State Forest has the best Roosevelt elk hunting on any public lands in the entire state of Oregon. And the camping and salmon fishing along the Millicoma River is very popular. And it's a very beautiful place. Selling this forest is not necessary to meet the legal mandates of the Common School Fund lands. Now, the State Land Board already studied the economics of selling the Elliott. In April of 2004, they issued a statement saying they had, quote, no intention of selling the Elliott Forest because of its importance to the Common School Fund portfolio. And I think Louise explained a little bit about why that was. This was in response to 2003 state legislator request for a study to compare the revenue from selling the Elliott with the revenue gleaned off of the Elliott. And invest, and if you sold the Elliott, investing the money in the Common School Fund land. The final news release about this study said, quote, a cost-benefit study for 84,000 acres, which is the amount of acres in the Common School Fund land, of the Elliott State Forest indicates that the fiscal impact of selling this portion of the forest could range from a loss for the state of $136 million to a gain of $206 million. The study concluded that the net present value of the forest under continued state ownership is near the midpoint of the net income if the forest was sold. That's the end of the quote from the DFL news release. Now, when you add in all the other values of the Elliott, selling it just doesn't pencil out. The study that I just quoted from assumed that the new HCP being developed would allow harvesting of 30 to 36 million board feet per year. But actually, as you heard earlier, it will be closer to 40 million board feet per year under the new HCP. Now, significant public funds have already been invested in preparing a new habitat conservation plan and forest management plan for the Elliott. And House Bill 3434 would not only waste this money, it would bypass the sensible and fair public process which we all want to be involved in. Managing the Elliott State Forest so the Habitat Conservation Plan meets all the constitutional requirements, as well as assures the public that this unique state forest can continue to support rare and threatened salmon and wildlife species, and provide recreation for Oregonians. So thank you very much for considering my testimony.
Thank you very much. Any questions? And there are no questions. So thank you, and I hope that you enjoy watching the rest of the hearing.
I will.
Okay. So next we have Bill Kluding from the Carpenters, and we might as well have a group, Ralph Saperstein and Bob Reagan.
So I'll start.
Okay.
Actually, Bob is part of my team,
okay,
and he can introduce himself. But Bill, if you'd like to go first, since your name was ahead of us on the roster, that's fine.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. For the record, Bill Kluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. You know, this is every session you folks come in and we have a budget problem. And the Elliott has been at the forefront of these sessions year after year after year. A lot of talk took place in 2003, enough to the point to where they had to do the study to see if the forest could be sold and how much the return would be. There was the problem starts, I think. It's not the Endangered Species Act that's holding us up. It's our interpretation of the Endangered Species Act. I'll just use myself for example. If I owned that forest and I needed to sustain the cut, I would follow the Endangered Species Act right to the letter. But I would use what is called a take avoidance approach. And what that is, you don't have to do the HCP and do the 60-year plan or whatever year plan you want. Take avoidance is when a spotted owl's nest is found, you draw a 70-acre circle around it and move on. You don't bother that. You don't have to shut down your whole forest and study for the last 15 years what we've been doing in that forest. And you've heard remarks to where it's an older forest. Well, if we keep studying it like this, it is going to be an old forest. Our kids, our schools deserve better than this. I'd like to see Oregon use every tool in their toolbox to create a budget to where you folks come in. You don't have the headaches that you have every session. Now, we could the way it's been going, and especially that Elliott Forest, our revenues are down, but our management costs are up, way up. And if we keep going the way we're working that forest, the management cost will be half of what the revenue is. And we don't need that. If we adopted the take avoidance approach for any species that pops up on the radar screen, and the federal folks are right there with you. I mean, they're going to point them out. You know, you've heard the mention of the marble murrelet. Well, you know, they've established the fact that it's part of the marble murrelet population, where there's tens and tens of thousands of them further north. These ones that are in our area, what few they are, I mean, I'd hate to see the man hours that's spent trying to find one. But these are just what got blowed down here in some of our fierce storms, and they never found their way back home. And for a marble murrelet, they don't set aside vast acres. They just set aside a few acres and move on. And I think this is what the approach that we're going to have to look at if we're going to get the revenues from our state forest that we should. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Ralph Saperstein. I'm here today representing Boise Cascade, Associated Oregon Loggers, and Douglas Timber Operators. And Mr. Reagan on my right works for Douglas Timber Operators. We had a discussion before our parents here, and he convinced me it was against my natural will, but I'm going to handle the color commentary of our testimony, and Mr. Reagan will handle the details and the specifics and the technical aspects. As Francis Etherington said on the telephone, the Elliott is a special place, and you should consider this bill rather than an anti-environment bill because it talks about selling. It really is the Elliott State Forest Restoration Bill, because the objective of the bill is to return the Elliott to a special to the special place it was when I first graduated from college and went down to the Elliott and worked as a forester there. The Elliott was such an out of the ordinary place because it had spectacular beauty of tall Douglas fir trees. Now I hear those trees are 30 years older now, but not only the tall Douglas fir, but they had the abundance of cool, clear water in the many streams on the Elliott and the steep coast range mountains. This stunning forest led me to think, you know, as a professional forester working on that land, that why in the world did I go to college? Because it was very difficult to work in the Elliott, but that's what made it so special, because it wasn't like forests on the east side or up in the Cascades that are flat. Not only is the Elliott steep, but but good nature added something to it, that Elliott has tremendous brush fields that make trying to move on the Elliott very difficult, and it used to be quite a challenge. But those forests, because the brush fields show that they're very productive, and they produce some of the highest grade Douglas fir lumber products in the world on the Elliott. The spectacular Elliott was the quintessential second growth forest, but it was second growth not because man planted it. It was second growth because big fires in the 1860s wiped it out, and the Elliott came back naturally. As we read in our newspaper, that if we aren't interested in the species or the time, forests will regrow, and Elliott's a great example of that. But these were natural forests that reforested themselves, and it developed into this special place, this popular recreation area, and a great supplier of commercial forest products at the same time. They're not exclusive. And the staff of the Elliott took great pride in their work, because unlike national forests, this state forest was special because it had such attractive qualities to it. The cool, clean water and the steep slopes and the tall Douglas fir trees was very attractive for recreation, whether it was people that were picking mushrooms or other forest products, or hunting or fishing, or even working with sometimes recreation. Most of the time it was death-defying, but it was a great experience. And the point is that this was special because of that. It was a working forest in the best term, in that people were able to maintain a standard of living from that forest while it maintained an extremely attractive recreational opportunity. And I thought I'd just take a second. He hasn't yanked me yet, so I'll go on. And it occurred to me while I was working there that a couple summers after I started, my aunt and uncle from San Francisco, who were liberal Democrats, so they fit into Oregon rather well. They came up to visit me because they couldn't believe that their favorite nephew was actually making a living managing forest land. They didn't think that forests were anything to be managed. But they came up to visit me, and I spent an afternoon on the weekend driving them around the area, showing them what I did and what the forest was like that I managed. They were in the coup de grace was at the end of the day when I drove them to a fire lookout and showed them the lookout and how somebody lives up there and spots fires. They thought that utopia of an existence would be ideal, and they considered selling their home and moving up to a fire lookout on the Elliott State Forest. But they were very impressed with the Elliott, and they felt that it compared to any of their other tour visits to this country's national forests, which were very awe-inspiring. But what that did for me is it convinced me that, yes, the Elliott is very special, yet it was, quote, a working forest. It produced valuable lumber products while still being a beautiful forest that was very attractive to recreationists, too. So I think that this bill will return the Elliott to the special place it was, because having the threat of the sale of the Elliott will encourage the forest managers to meet their trust responsibilities and hopefully lead to the Elliott State Forest once again being the special place that it was, as an extremely productive second growth forest. And if anybody wants to compare that, all you have to do is look at the federal forest lands either to the north of the Elliott, the south of the Elliott, or to the east of the Elliott. And we don't have that situation on federal forest lands. That's what makes the Elliott unique. Mr. Reagan.
Thank you. Chairman Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Robert Reagan. I am executive director of Douglas Timber Operators in Roseburg, a regional forest products trade association. We represent mills, loggers, and timberland owners in Lane, Coos, and Douglas counties. Our members employ over 8,000 workers in the woods and the mills. My apologies to Representative Dingfelder, because you've heard this in my remarks before. So anyway, hopefully the rest of you will be able to stay with me, and I hope she will too. Thank you. I'm here to register support for HB 3434 and voice our concerns about the proposed management plan for the Elliott State Forest, which we believe severely shortchanges Oregon schools. We recognize that the management of this common school fund asset is the responsibility of the State Land Board, but the legislature has to do the heavy lifting to fund schools throughout our state. The less the Elliott provides for school funding, the more must be made up in general revenues that at some times can be in short supply. I'm sure you all know what those days are like. This past year, the Board of Forestry generously allowed us to make several modeling runs of the Elliott Forest so that we could demonstrate the opportunity cost of the state's pursuit of a habitat conservation plan. This HCP, which will last 55 years, provides no-touch reserves on 27% of the forest and severe harvest constraints on the balance. We developed two modeling runs, one which managed the Elliott under what we call take avoidance strategy. And a take avoidance strategy is where you go out and you look at the forest, you plan to do some harvesting and you survey for species that are out there, whether they're marbled mullets, spotted owls, or whatever. And whatever you find determines whether or not you continue on with your harvest plans. The two strategies that we modeled were, one was if the Elliott were managed under the Oregon Forest Practices Act requirements as if it were privately owned. We then ran a more constrained alternative to provide greater protection of spotted owls, similar to what the state is following on the Tillamook State Forest. The results of these modeling runs have been provided to the Board of Forestry and the State Land Board. In the handout provided are two graphs that came out of the modeling work. There's a bunch of them. I only selected two. These two I chose because they graphically show the problem. The top graph shows the return on asset value for the Elliott plan in the red line. That's this one right here. And the blue line is the intermediate alternative that we developed, which is the more constrained management plan to accommodate owls and merlets. You'll see that the based on the on this asset value return, the Elliott starts at below 3% in the first decade and drops down to below 2% by the second the end of the second decade. That's the return on the value of the asset. No, thanks.
It's from the Elliott.
Good water. The bottom graph shows a change in standing merchantable timber inventory over the planning horizon of 150 years. The top line is the Elliott State Forest Plan. The blue line is the intermediate alternative that we developed. And then the red line is what would possibly occur on the Elliott if it was managed under Oregon Forest Practices Act. As you can see, on the top line, the Elliott continues to grow more timber every year than it's planned to be harvested. Under the intermediate alternative that we developed, it basically harvests the growth on the forest. The simple reason the state plan return on asset value is low is that much of the growth of the forest goes into inventory. The only way the forest can provide funding for schools is for the trees to be sold and harvested. Within the 55-year term of the proposed HCP, the standing inventory will increase by 50%, climbing by from 2.3 billion feet to over 3 billion feet. The second page of my handout to you is really very simplistic. It is an illustration of who owns the forest in the state of Oregon. I borrowed this from the Department of Forestry also. It's very handy to illustrate what we're talking about here. The big tree on the left are our federal forest lands. The two middle-sized trees, one is industrial private timberlands, the other small woodlands. And this little small brown tree down here represents the state forest. The Elliott would be about a third of this small little brown tree. My point in illustrating this to you is simple. 55% of our forest lands in Oregon, the federal forests, are basically off-limits to timber harvest. We're not harvesting out there. That's the reason that Congress has been deliberating what to do about the safety net. Our counties and local schools in rural Oregon are suffering dramatically because those federal forest lands are not producing. Our question in looking at the Elliott is why do we need to, the state of Oregon, take one-third of this little brown tree and turn it into a significant habitat reserve for wildlife species also, when there is an alternative way to manage it? And I think that's the question that really I would like to see you folks deliberate. Again, it's the state land board's call on how this forest is to be managed, but we have been shortchanging Oregon schools for a long time. And an HCP that lasts for 55 years is not going to create much of a difference. Now, I want to depart from my prepared remarks because you asked some questions, and I have a couple answers, Chairman. This is the report that was developed for the modeling runs that we did with the Oregon Department of Forestry model and with Dr. John Sessions. And it shows, this is a long-winded answer to your question, how much is the forest growing? It depends on how long you want to grow your trees. The peak of the Elliott for its growth occurs with about an 80-year rotation. That means every 80 years you harvest trees and start all over again. And the growth there is 64 million feet a year. So that's the growth on the forest if you manage the forest under an 80-year rotation. The other question that has popped up, and I think it deserves some deliberation, and that is the return on the revenue stream, based on what the Department of Forestry is planning for the Elliott versus where we have been. And I would refer to a PowerPoint presentation made to the Board of Forestry in June of 2005, and it shows the present harvest of 27 million feet a year and the revenue of $15 million a year. If you take the proposed habitat conservation plan, even though the cut goes up to 40 million feet a year, the revenue stream stays at $15 million a year. And the reason that is because they have constrained the harvest on the non-reserve part of the forest. Their logging costs are higher, their management costs are higher, and they're harvesting lower quality timber. So the revenue stream, even though they're talking about increasing the harvest levels, doesn't change. One final comment, I'll leave alone, is the value of the forest. We have, as part of the modeling run that ODF did for us, we ended up with making three calculations of present net value based on three different management schemes. The present net value of the Elliott, based on the proposed habitat conservation plan, is $359 million a year, $359 million. Based on managing the forest under the Oregon Forest Practices Act, that present net value goes up to $747 million a year. It's more than double. And so those are really some broad ranges of the value of the Elliott. With that concludes my remarks. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We only have two more people.
Quick question, Mr. Chair.
Okay, quick question and quick answer. Okay.
I'm just like, what is the average diameter breast height on the 80-year-old trees? What I'm looking for, and foresters will understand this, is can this stuff go through any millhead?
Check. Once it gets to which age tree?
80-year-old.
Out there, you're probably looking at probably 20 to 22 inches in diameter. And a lot of the timber out there is this big. It's a very excellent growing timber site.
Because above 35 inches becomes a serious problem suddenly. Yeah. Sorry. Because we have no big block wall stuff.
That's true. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ivan. We had this planned pretty well if education had gotten out on time.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ivan Maluski. I'm with the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club, and I apologize. I'm just going to very quickly move through this because I have a work group I had to get to a few minutes ago on water issues. I will say that the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club opposes HB 3434. Part of the reason is that the Elliott does contain some of the oldest forests in state ownership, and it is a public resource. It belongs to all Oregonians, and it should not be unsustainably logged, nor should it be sold into private ownership. Significant public funds have gone into the creation of this new habitat conservation plan, and they would essentially be abandoned if 3434 would go through. My colleague Francis Etherington from Elk Watersheds mentioned earlier that there was a 2004 cost-benefit study of the Elliott, which suggested that selling off the 84,000 acres of common school lands could cost the state up to $136 million. I think it would be unwise if this body did not consider that information before making a decision on this bill. There's a lot of other values. Public schools have a huge value, and I think the current plan in place, we're supporting public schools with the forest. So I think that I just wanted to address one question that Representative Clement asked. I think part of the reason why the private industry doesn't have such an onerous situation on their private lands nearby is not only because the Elliott has older forests where the critters live, so to speak, but also because the Elliott and nearby federal lands sort of bear the burden of the Endangered Species Act for these private lands. One way we could look at it is if we wanted to have a more aggressive approach on the Elliott, we are going to have impacts on the private forest sector down in that area. They're going to have to pay a bigger burden in terms of habitat set-asides and compliance with the ESA. So it's all of these forests are connected. These watersheds are connected. You can't take one piece and increase the logging and not have an impact somewhere else. It's part of the situation with these species that have been brought to the brink through past logging practices. So I think there will be real-world impacts for the private sector if we were to go to an approach that really abandons the current protection levels for endangered species on the Elliott. So just in summation, the Elliott State Forest is paying its fair share in terms of logging right now. It's not only provides a habitat for species and recreation opportunities, but it's paying a really big share into the Common School Fund. It belongs to the people of Oregon, and the revenues from responsible logging that is sustainable in the long term belong to Oregon school children. Unsustainable short-term logging and privatizing this forest really makes no sense for the long term. Thanks for your consideration.
Thank you.
Get out of here. Thank you.
Thank you. And our last person, David, from Senator Verger's office.
For the record, my name is David Martin. I'm staff for Senator Joanne Verger. Senator Verger just wanted me to read her testimony into record. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the revenue from the Elliott State Forest is a part of the Common School Fund. It is the fiduciary obligation of the State Land Board to manage these trust lands for maximum revenue. While there is some doubt that any legislation can dictate to the State Land Board, there is little doubt about the little doubt that the Elliott has not been managed up to its sustainable yield. In the 05-07 biennium, the Common School Fund reached $93.9 million thanks to the successful investments by the Oregon Investment Council. That does not change the fact that in 2007, the harvest level will be 22.08 million board feet per year, far below its presumed potential of at least 40 million board feet per year. I want the Elliott to be well managed. I want a sound conservation plan. But, Mr. Chairman, I request that this committee recommend to the members of the Land Board that any 60-year plan for the Elliott have full public hearings and contain no delisted species. I would also recommend that if the Elliott cannot be managed to produce maximum revenue for its part of the Common School Fund, that the State Land Board notify the legislature and allow legislation such as House Bill 3434 to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So is there anyone else here who would like to speak who hasn't had a chance? As long as it's quick.
Thank you.
So we'll have education's coming back, and they wanted the room. We're using some of the time that they put off on us. So.
I am Barbara Wilson, and I live in Beaverton, Oregon. I just wanted to mention I am an active member of Portland Audubon, and I am not authorized to speak for Audubon, but I do want you to understand that there has been misinformation regarding the spotted owl and the marbled murrelet, because both these birds are struggling for survival, struggling against extinction in Oregon and Washington and California. So you really, in order to have a full picture of the importance of the Elliott Forest in these two species of birds, you really should have a spokesperson who really knows what they're talking about with regarding these two birds. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other? Seeing none, thank you all for being here and for the testimonies. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3434. And anything else for my one other minute?
No, it's just you and I.
We will also close the meeting of the Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. Thank you all.